We haven't even started yet. This is the afternoon session, and there will be a break from 5 to 5:30 and an early evening session from 5:30 to 7 p.m. today. As usual, at the beginning of the session, the chair reads the following. Anyone wishing to address the committee on matters not appearing on the agenda may do so now. The public may comment on any matter listed on the agenda at the time the matter is being considered by the committee. And we can even adjust the time on something, maybe, to accommodate a member of the public if necessary. There will be a time limit of not more than 5 minutes for each speaker. No action will be taken by the committee on matters brought up under this item, but they may be referred to staff for further study, response, or action. With that, if there is any member of the public here who would like to say anything now, you're welcome to do it. If not, we will turn the session back to Mr. Oatley, and it's your ball.
All right. Thank you very much. Our first presenter today is Brad Hines. He's our outage manager, and he's going to be addressing the committee on the 1R13 refueling outage overview.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Brad. Welcome.
Thank you. I pull my cheat sheet out a little bit. Okay. Go ahead. This is just my cover slide here. Next slide, please. I've got two topics I'm going to talk about today in a general sense. One is the 1R13 results, and then we'll follow up with the planning for 2R13, which is our spring outage coming up here in April. So for the 1R13, these are the high-level issues I want to talk about, the results versus goals. Some of the areas where we made some process improvements during the outage that reaped us some benefits, and then, as always, an overview of the safety plan performance. The committee is always interested in hearing that. With regards to our goals and results for the outage, you can see the way we have column formats laid out here, a familiar format. We made some improvements in some areas for 1R13 overall, but we certainly have gaps that we want to close for being the best in the industry, and that's our overall objective. If you look in the areas of safety, our goals for the outage were zero injuries in the industrial safety realm. We had no disabling injuries during the outage, but we were completely unsatisfied with our performance in industrial safety with regards to recordable injuries. The injuries themselves were minor in nature, but all preventable in a sense. Mostly, when you look at common causes around those injuries, they tended to be around situational awareness. People doing lower level tasks, if you will, basically either taking their mind off the game for a minute or losing awareness of hazards in their area and getting injured in a fashion doing those type of activities. So for our 2R13 safety awareness program, we're going to specifically be targeting, situational awareness and how we can raise that level of consciousness. Those are the type of examples I'm talking about.
Now, these guys didn't go right back to work, though. They went to the infirmary or something?
Well, each one of them has a different set of treatment, if you will. But in general, what they did is they were taken for medical treatment. The treatment was rendered, and then they were available to go back to work.
Yeah, this is not what you call a lost time accident.
That's right.
Not disabled.
Not disabled. That's right. So it basically required a medical treatment of some form, sutures or of that nature. Okay.
Just a quick question. You talked about the unhappiness with these kinds of problems.
Absolutely.
And in terms of corrective action, are there absolute things that you saw that you think you can apply to a fix for this? Or is it just something that you're going to have to try to continue to push? Are there some concrete things that you think you've established that you can, they're transferable to the correction of the problem?
I have a firm belief that we can do better than we have this outage for sure. And, you know, relative to the industry, we know that the industry does better than this in a refueling outage. And so we're pulling every string we can with regards to benchmarking practices, other things that others do to get the level of awareness up that we can prevent these. I know our leadership has passion about that. I don't know if I gave you that concrete answer of a silver bullet. I don't think we have that. I think what it has to do is has to do with an organizational awareness to really raise that standard of awareness, not only for yourself, but for anyone in your vicinity, any situation you might see that could eventually lead to an injury. The precursors that could be there, that if you don't notice them yourself, does somebody else see it for you and tap you on the shoulder and say, hey, did you see that beam above your head? You know, those are the type of things that we really need to pull together as a team and reinforce to get us to where we need to be.
But I guess as we speak, there's no absolute one or two things that you think you were able to discover during the course of the outage that you could apply and say, this will really help fix the problem.
I'm turning to Dave on that. Do you have a better answer for that than I do?
I would say no. There's no pattern to the injuries. For example, in a hand injury, if you wore gloves, you could preclude it, or a back injury, so you could warm up, you could preclude it. And if you do know the pattern is the injuries occurred when typically when setting up or tearing down for a job, and there seems to be more situational awareness. And so there's not a single action you can take to kill, you know, all five from occurring in the future, other than reinforcing as we are today the situational awareness and just being aware of the hazards.
And these are PG&E employees, not contractors, right?
Two of these were contracted employees.
Oh, they were.
Two of these contract and PG&E. Oh,
okay. Well,
if you look at the sort of the level or the threshold for things counting as an injury and being taken seriously, it is at the level where it's sort of routinely around the house, you know, cutting vegetables or whatever, similar things can happen. And of course, the motivation for doing this is you don't want to increase the risk or get close to the threshold where you could have serious injuries occurring. And so this is a good precursor. But it also, because you're setting the threshold fairly low, it may be that some workers won't take it seriously. And so how do you work to instill the correct attitudes when you are basically setting a threshold which some people would think was just, you know, too minor of an event to really warrant a significant response?
I think every minor injury is a near miss for a major injury.
Yeah.
And I think every individual can personalize the fact that they don't come to work on any given day with any desire or intention to get hurt. Even minor, even a couple stitches, right? No one wants that. And in most cases, when you look at those, you can say, boy, it could have been worse.
Yeah.
And so you could go after that perspective and that mindset and attitude adjustment from a lot of different angles. I think the argument for industrial and personnel safety is real compelling with the employees themselves. No one wants to get hurt for themselves or for their families, or, you know, those are the real compelling reasons.
And so to add to that answer, I think then it's incumbent upon leadership, supervisors, and up to maintain a safety awareness. In other words, keep it in front of it.
With regards to what prevents injuries is also what prevents other types of events, too. The nature of the events here, once again, were somewhat of a scatter. Some of them were latent in nature, in that we had an event where we had a core reactor fuel load sequence error, basically as a transposition error in the design document to the load sequencing paperwork. So very tough one for the implementers in the field to find that. But we do have processes where we do verifications of those documents, and so it's indicative of how much rigor it takes to weed these type of things out of our performance. But we need to get there.
And not to minimize it, but you've got 5 reportable injuries, 4 human performance events. Can you put that in perspective and tell us how many work hours there were during the outage, or how many? I'm not sure we had a
denominator
here, but how much work have these compared to how much work was done?
A typical refueling outage has about 110,000 scheduled work hours, but those are the activities that actually show person hours in the schedule. You usually would assume that for the support activities that may not show scheduled activities, but it's field support, radiation protection, for example, that type of support, we'll roll that up to 200,000 man hours. And then if you included basically all the personnel hours on site for supportive personnel and everything else, you're pushing up almost to 500,000 man hours or person hours for the total outage hours on, if you want to add it up, and those are kind of big numbers. Those are typical numbers. I didn't come in prepared for those facts for 113, but that's order magnitude.
Brad, when we were here in December for the fact finding, and we had a rundown on this, additional to those, we had some problems. They all seem to me to be human performance related. Rigging practice, you just mentioned the core, loss of 230 kV power.
That's correct.
Procedure use. Have y'all, or are you going to do a root cause analysis on either each one of these or all of them, just to try to put them together to see what really was caused us? Have you done that yet, or your process? Or?
I know that the root cause analysis for each of these events definitely gets performed, and we expect to turn those around in a 30-day turnaround period. I'm not involved in every one of those root cause analysis, so I can't state from my own personal knowledge that they're all done. I expect they are. Have they been integrated into a common cause analysis? I'm not aware of that.
Those 4 were rolled up into analysis that operations, engineering, and maintenance did, which is where most of the errors occurred in those 2 organizations, over the entire year. So they looked at a common cause over the whole year, and that's just finishing up.
That's probably something we ought to include in a fact-finding meeting to look at that and see what the corrective action is.
Okay, moving on to the other results here. The next few have to do with the actual outage performance from the work completion perspective. Power ascension, we had a very smooth power ascension this time, no equipment reliability issues during our power ascension. And that was one of, power ascension is a good measure of equipment reliability that we performed during the outage, that the equipment starts up and runs well. That was a big deal for us because we didn't do a major low-pressure turbine replacement project this outage, and so there was a lot of vulnerability to equipment problems during startup from that major of the job, and it started up very well. And the next bullet there, reliable run at 100%, and that's a number of days. Basically what that says is that we got up to power, and then we stayed at power. We didn't have equipment reliability problems right after the outage that brought us back down. We're up to about 75 days now. Actually, it is 75 days today. So we're pleased with that performance, and that we appear to have chosen the right scope to ensure reliable operation post-outage. And the quality of, it's also a measure of the quality of work that our folks performed during the outage.
You didn't have the same equipment problems during startup of this outage that you had in some of the prior outages.
We are continuing to analyze that post-outage to validate that we're not getting bit by equipment reliability issues affecting our startups post-outage. This one, we had a small number of events relative to what we've had in our previous outages. We'll never be to a point, I think, where we'll say we don't even have
it. Outages, the equipment problems were much, much reduced. And I think quality verification, you'll hear later today, they removed that as one of the top 10 issues for the station.
Those performance in 1R13, we improved our dose performance relative to Unit 1 outage performance. In the past, 116 person rim is the lowest dose performance for refueling outage on Unit 1. We beat our estimate by quite a bit while accomplishing all the scope that we intended to accomplish. We still are an relative to the industry for plants that do similar type scope. This is an area where we still have a gap that we need to improve on, so we're going to continue to focus.
How big a gap?
We're about an industry median between the two units. About industry median is our performance between the two units. So if you look at top quartile performance, we should be getting about 20 person rim less. 80 or so person rim will get us there, okay. Top quartile.
So once again, our focus there is really in optimizing the work that we do. And because I'm just sitting here.
Ask any questions. I think I'd like to appeal that you start using collective dose instead of ALARA.
Sure.
That's really what it is.
Radiation exposure, effect radiation dose is.
Yeah, but that's all it is. ALARA is more than that. And I want to try and get people to think that ALARA is planning, it's thinking, doing stuff. Collective dose, it's a meaningless figure as far as health effects are concerned. It's a measure that's easy to measure. And that's what you measure here, is collective dose.
I understand.
And I agree with that also. Certainly in our planning and preparation, our focus is ALARA.
That's right.
And then how do we achieve the scope that we need to achieve in the most cost-effective, most efficient, and most reliable fashion possible?
And safe.
Correct. And then the outage duration, we ended up a little over 2 days from our scheduled duration. And the main challenge there was our LP retrofit project. We had delays in several different areas in the implementation of that project, and that's what turned out to be our critical path of the outage, if you will.
That's where they're getting breaking.
Okay. Let's go on to the next. This is a pretty long list, and so in the interest of time, I won't run you through the entire list. What I can do is I can pick out a couple that I would call maybe the outage manager's top three, if you will, of the improvements that I thought was of real value to us. This outage we did, our 1R13, we did have an operation super crew alignment during the outage. What that means is basically you have half the operations resources permanently on day shift during the outage and the other half on night shift. The reason, as an outage manager, I certainly liked that is it ensured we had adequate staffing to perform the work that we need to do and didn't catch ourselves short-staffed during evolutions, key operations evolutions during the outage. But even bigger than that, I really do like the fact that when operation stays on crew, they do have to be rotating back and forth between day shift and night shift. And it worries me from a human performance perspective that people can get fatigued doing that during the course of a refueling outage. And so having the super crew arrangement certainly was a benefit in not having people's sleep patterns disrupted during the course of the refueling outage.
Now, you're just speaking of the crew with the outage. The other crew stays on their normal rotation?
No, the entire operations department. All of the management, all the bargaining units.
But I mean for both units?
Basically, all... The entire department. They do have the non-outage crew that stays on their on the still working unit too, but it's the entire department. We don't have half a small subset that's still rotating around. That was for 1R13. Operations is addressing how they're going to staff in 2R13, and so there may be some issues with that, but there certainly were some benefits in 1R13 by going to that alignment. The second one I'll call out is we perform a different series of what I call vertical splice reviews of our Schedule 3 outage. What I mean by vertical splice is that they're integrated across projects, across basically if you take a time slot of the outage schedule, you'll look at every project and the entire schedule in that time frame. And we did that both as somewhat of a gap in making sure that the key operations leadership who are actually going to be implementing the outage were appraised of the overall plan for implementation of the outage. They get a lot of training on what type of mods are going to be implemented during the outage, and so they know what that's going to look like. And they get some training on the outage safety plan, and so they get a feel for that. What we hadn't been doing real well for them is to lay out how the schedule flows and the key coordination areas that operations are going to be involved in during the course of the outage, and why, basically the whys on why we built the plan in that fashion. And I think it gave us some real benefit during the course of the outage that mentally the operations leadership who are going to go implement these activities had a chance to pre-think it, ask their questions ahead of time, and be aware of why these items were important to our execution and plan accordingly.
In the absence of that in the past, how did you relay, how did you communicate their roles?
What we had is we have outage window managers from the operations department who basically did the lion's share of the planning on behalf of the department.
I see.
And they're excellent individuals, but I'd be hamstrung without them. They're really sharp, and they're key to our building a great plan. But the communication part to the rest of the team was something that was hampering them during the implementation phase, because they were having to go up and explain to the control room why a certain sequence of events were laid out that way, you know, near the time of implementation. And that's something that we felt they should understand that ahead of the time.
Good, thanks.
The third one I'll call out here was a real benefit. It's listed in pre-outage because we decided to do it pre-outage, but it was really during implementation, during 1R13, was the shift outage director oversight roles. It was a new position that we staffed in the outage control center during the outage, and we received some real benefits from having the senior leadership in the field, helping to facilitate any decision-making or issue resolution. The eyes-on ability to get senior leadership in the field and come back and relate to the rest of the leadership exactly what the circumstances were, I think it really helped us resolve issues much quicker, and the quality of the issue resolution was enhanced also.
Brad, what level of manager was it?
It was the maintenance services director on night shift and the ops services director on day shift.
Last October at the public meeting when Mr. Perkis made his presentation, he indicated that this would be the first time that you'd be trying out this role. And I guess I'm pleased to hear that you found satisfaction in doing it in this manner.
I thought it worked well for us. We've actually taken a couple runs at this in the past, but our implementation was not as stellar as I think we had some people who had a better vision of what that role would look like and were able to show us.
As a result of this, do you find that you had the right category of individual performing that function?
I was very pleased. I thought we had the right people helping us in that capacity.
Okay.
They're confident that they're the decision point on these kinds of things, right?
Well, it depends on the nature of the circumstances, but oftentimes they certainly do have the authority to make the decision on the spot.
And they know that they can certainly analyze it later on to see for learning purposes, but in terms of responsibility, their decision is respected. That's it?
Absolutely. You have to build a safe environment, of course, in doing that, because certainly, you know, just by position, a director may have a lot of authority, but they may not be the subject matter expert. And so if you're talking about rigging evolutions, then you need a qualified professional rigger to be able to make the call and make sure that we're doing everything exactly right when you're actually doing those type of evolutions. So they're in no way do I mean to imply that they're making technical decisions that they're not qualified to do. What they're really doing is helping remove barriers that are impeding progress.
I assume that they are qualified, though, to get the input from the right people and confirm a decision.
Yeah, generally what the nature of what they were doing that helped us the most was getting the right resources to bear on an issue that was occurring. Basically, they had the authority to call up who they needed to help break through a barrier and say, I need your help and I need it now. Were there any others? I don't know if intervening and assisting the contractor in a teaming way, but basically doing everything we could bear our resources upon to help them succeed. And so we established a separate command center in a conference room in the admin building. We teamed a lot of our key players, schedulers, project managers, senior leadership, with their project management team. They brought their senior leadership out and basically worked as a team to help resolve these issues. And I thought that was a real success for us, as opposed to taking the position of it's contracted work, we're going to just sit back and demand that the contractor perform and watching them struggle. I think it was a much more effective way to get the desired result and team with the contractor in the process.
I had a follow-up on that subject just very quickly. I'm looking at the December 5th issue of Current Times, and it talks about the very subject you're talking about, and that's the Coordination Center. But it has an interesting short paragraph there talking about the turbine project's rough start began when the outage started early, before the overhead cranes on the turbine deck were ready. Can you speak at least briefly to that issue?
Yeah, I probably wouldn't characterize that statement as accurate. We did have problems with our turbine building overhead cranes right at the beginning of the refueling outage. They were emergent failures, and there's certainly some lessons learned that we had regarding that. Matter of fact, they probably fall in the category of what we talked about earlier about equipment reliability. We had just performed maintenance outage windows on those cranes because they're available to perform maintenance online just in the preceding weeks.
I see.
So those cranes, we believed them to be ready. We had some emergent failures that impacted us.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's go on to the next one. So safety plan performance, or safety schedule performance, if you will, for 1R13. We had 12 safety schedule change evaluations that we performed during the outage. Just for comparison's purposes, in recent refueling outages, we had 18 total in 2R12 and 24 in 1R12. So we didn't find ourselves in a situation that often where we felt we needed to evaluate a change relative to, is it a reduction in defense and depth for our safety plan? Of those five change evaluations, of those 12, only five of them did indeed actually impact the safety plan in any way. We do the evaluation, and we think it's a good thing to do an evaluation at a very low threshold. No harm, no foul. You do the evaluation. If it's no reduction in defense and depth, that's good, and we proceed. Five of them did have a reduction of defense and depth below our original plan. All five of those were due to emerging issues during the outage. So it wasn't a part of our plan that we should have foreseen as part of our safety planning.
Could you give an example of one of those?
Pardon me?
Could you give an example of one?
Sure. We had the start of transformer basically has a load tap changer that automatically taps to adjust the voltage for the transformer. and it had a relay that failed while we were on a single source of offsite power. So as part of operations response to that, they manually adjusted the load tap changer to validate the correct operation in manual of that load tap changer, and for a very brief period of time put us at a voltage range where technically the startup power was inoperable for a short period of time. Operationally, startup power was completely functional during that period of time, and they quickly exited that condition. But they definitely wanted to validate that we didn't have a bigger problem. So that's an example of one that when the condition occurred, we go back and do the safety plan change evaluation assessment kind of after the fact for a couple of reasons. One, just to document that we are aware of our safety condition at all times and have evaluated how bad was it. And second, to make sure we learn the lessons post-outage for anything that we can go back and evaluate and say, gee, this was avoidable, or there's something we should learn for contingency planning purposes and future outages.
In that case, do you go so far as to change your risk profile for that?
Actually, no, it did not impact the risk profile at all.
Okay.
That's kind of the bottom line, too, is all of these changes. I think I did put the slide in because your alarm is telling you you got an unhealthy detector. And so basically, as part of that troubleshooting, we entered that condition twice to validate that we actually fixed that detector.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I guess say another way, none of these were done for convenience.
Absolutely not.
They were done because we assumed certain equipment would be available due to emergency equipment issues. They weren't available,
yeah.
So that's why we didn't do that.
Yeah.
There's still a lot of value in doing those, even though the condition is imposed on you, because that's what makes sure that in a timely fashion we look at the circumstances we're in. We may be in that condition for a while if it's something that you didn't expect to break, if it's broken, and there may be some real valid contingency planning or schedule adjustment to improve your safety status that you should be taking action on, and that's what that evaluation is designed to make sure we do.
Thanks.
Any other questions regarding 1R13?
Risk profile.
Sure.
Go ahead. No, you go.
The dash line across the middle, is that symbolic of anything? Does that mean anything? Or?
Yeah, that's yeah. Basically the average risk.
What, during the outage?
Yeah, that's you just basically are showing what that value would be for the average.
All right, and once the outage is over on the very right-hand side, where would that risk level go?
Oh, you mean when you get into online risk?
Normal operation. Where would that line be?
You know, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
Relative to, you know, the whole risk process changes from online to outage.
Yeah, this is a risk of boiling per hour, so we're in the one in a 10 million chance on average. And online, we measure it more on the core damage frequency, so it's a different measurement.
Right, yeah.
But so that's why it's not directly comparable.
Yeah.
There's also, there were some issues associated with rigging during the outage that had cropped up. Could you review those?
Sure. That was one of our critical equipment, critical human performance clock resets, so that was one of those four major events. We were rigging RCP, mm-hmm. and basically we had a sling fail on the RCP while it was in the air. Now, we did not drop the RCP, but it did swing. And that was a rigging error. It was basically a wrong padding for the protection for the sling material was selected in performing that work. So while the actual, no one got hurt, the equipment didn't get damaged, there wasn't a consequence, the near miss was so significant that we thought that was a very significant event because of the how big a near miss that was.
Was that one of your four human performance clock
resets? Yes, it was.
What kind of follow-up is taking place on that?
There was, once again, that's one where they do a root cause analysis on why the event occurred. I was not part of that team, but there's some detailed follow-up with regards to the whole root cause and you know, any sort of accountability as necessary.
There may have also been some issues with rigging safety and the low pressure turbine work.
The turbine deck is certainly a when you're replacing 3LP rotors, there's just constantly something up in the air. With regards to the significant issues there, nothing that came to my attention, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were people concerned about that. One of the big areas we were concerned about pre-outage was, you know, the turbine deck is also kind of a main thoroughfare for a lot of our workers, and just the potential for awareness of overhead loads. And so we did have to reinforce that several times during the course of the outage, was awareness of overhead loads, and the people, when you mentioned that, the people who are not used and are qualified to be around suspended loads, they tend to think that things will drop straight down. And so we had some education to do, and to say, just because you're not walking directly under the load doesn't mean you're unacceptably within the vicinity of the load. You know, if a load were to drop for any reason, then there's a pretty wide radius outside the direct downfall that you need to be way clear of for your own personal safety. And then, of course, for the safety of the people who are actually performing the evolution, anybody in their vicinity can become a distraction to them, and we want to keep them clear for that purpose, too.
There were two cases during the turbine retrofit where heavy loads, lifts were made, and interferences came apparent after the lift started. So they're moving the load and interfered in another area, and they had to set it back to its original location. I was aware of that during the outage. And there's a couple other issues that were documented during the outage that we're looking into.
These need to, you know, during implementation, that need to be monitored really look like. And having our project management manager basically be the person who reviews those plans for quality purposes and consistency, I think has paid a lot of benefits in getting more consistency of the oversight of our non-station personnel. We were well aware of what was going on. You know, we talk about Alstom performance and our contractor performance during the outage. That was implementation performance. I was not concerned from a perspective of we didn't know what they were doing or weren't monitoring that. We were monitoring it all too well for their comfort, I think. We were basically we had a lot of suggestions for them to improve their performance, and we were looking for results.
Were contractor personnel always supervised by PG&E personnel during the outage?
Oh, no. No, quite often you'll have, the contractor have their own supervision. If you contract a full scope of work, then they will have their own supervision.
Under the strict definition of supervision, that's exactly right. However, if we end up in circumstances where contractors are supervising their own work, we then have more contract oversight of that. So there's PG intervention in the work activities to check the quality of work along the way. So I don't know of a case where we just stand back and let them do whatever they want, and, you know, hopefully if it's done right, we always have checkpoints to do it.
Chad, I have one more.
Sure.
After the December NSOC meeting, there is a subcommittee on work control and conduct and maintenance. And their report said, or talked about the rigor that was applied to schedule and accomplishments in that area and satisfaction by supervisors that things didn't bounce around and that they were able to move ahead on schedule. And then the next bullet says, on the other hand, supervisors indicated that schedule accountability had some possible unintended consequences. I'm sure you've seen this paragraph over and over. Specifically, it appeared to them that production was emphasized over preparation and prevention. Obviously, you've got to draw some kind of a balance between absolute rigor and let every idea bloom and not keep it any tight control. We've already heard, you mentioned it, and so did others, that you had the maintenance director and the ops director in a position to make decisions that could not, that involved changes and emerging work and things that, that might have less than a simplistic answer. I think that's great. And what I would hope is that you're able to continue looking at that, see if you can give people more assurance that the answer won't always be absolutely we don't make any changes, that there will be enough breathing space made to evaluate, make a decision, and even if there are long-term benefits, that they can get weighed in there too, even though it might cost you a few hours. Obviously, if it's going to screw everything up on the schedule, that's not going to be appealing to you. But I think it's so important that people know that if there is a good reason to do something and that the impacts are within bounds, that there's a possibility to consider it. And certainly, if there's a safety implication, that you don't say, no, we're not making any changes, but the first thought is there safety involved here? And if so, somebody be able to make the decision that in this case, maybe we can do something that doesn't keep to within the rigor that we keep talking about.
Sure. I guess I could respond to that by saying I think your statement aligns real well with my perspectives on that also. I think you hit it right on the head with regards to the proper understanding. And what's key in that is really the part about the communication of why there are schedule impacts. When we build a plan for a refueling outage, we have every intention to go out there and implement that plan exactly as it's scheduled. And we'll tell our folks, build a plan that you can go out there and from day one to day 39 of the outage, you'll be right on your schedule. We also okay.
Brad, you got about 15 minutes.
15 minutes. Okay, so I have a lot of slides here, but I think we can cut to the chase on most of these.
Great.
So the 2 or 13 topics, we'll cover what the goals are. That will go relatively quickly. Give you an overview of the T-scope. You might have a few questions there. And then as time allows, we'll talk about improvement initiatives and the current status of our preparations and the safety plan. Okay? The goals for 2 or 13 should look very familiar to you. They are our standard set of goals, and we're well aligned with what the industry standards for good performance will be in those goals. If you look at the next page.
I can't resist this.
Okay.
On radiological safety, collective dose.
We'll fix that.
And I don't see a stretch goal, and I hope you won't put one in.
We are doing that.
Quick.
100 gram is a stretch goal. We're not gonna
oh!
That's right.
It ought to be the best you can do with the best thinking you've got.
It's achievable.
That's expectable. That you're gonna do that, and
then
don't objective. And don't let anybody say, well, okay, cut it by 10%, because that's when you get in trouble.
Okay. The only comment I'll make on this 2R13 objectives slide. These are basically other things we intend to accomplish that aren't listed in our plan business plan goals. See that one that says greater than or equal to 99%? Interpret that as 100%, okay? We have no intention of not doing the corrective maintenance during the refueling outage that we need to do. So,
stark realism.
There you go. Moving on to the next. Here are some of the, typically when we do a short turnaround between refueling outages, which this is a very short turnaround between 1R13 and 2R13, we intend to try to keep the scope between the two outages very similar to optimize our planning. In this case, due to circumstances in our long-range plans, we have to do some things, some major things in 2R13 that we didn't do in 1R13. And so that's a challenge for us, but we're going to do them, and we're going to do them successfully. Top one is our puller crane. That's the big crane inside the containment. We've had reliability issues with that crane for years. And we have well-documented tasks of the crane having problems that have, you know, it's a business risk situation. It's not a risk of dropping a load or of a safety nature, but it is certainly a big business risk in that when we need the crane to be reliable in order to implement our plan, we have a history of unreliability. So to adjust that, we're doing major modifications on the crane controls, and it's a really big job coordinated in containment on the crane itself. So that's very significant to us, and is also a good portion of the main critical path duration of the outage.
Is this history different from Unit 1?
No, Unit 1 has the same problem.
Already done or in the future?
Not done. So that's in our upcoming outages for Unit 1. The next bullet there, the RCS upflow and upper head temperature reduction modifications. Just a one-liner on what that is. Those are modifications to the internals of the reactor vessels to address a couple of issues that are industry issues and also issues for our plant. One is to address the fuel baffle jet impingement issue on fuel assemblies. Yeah, that's what the upflow modification does, is basically eliminates the flow characteristics that would cause potential flow from impinging the external fuel assemblies around the core load from a baffle jetting type of degradation concern. So that's what that modification does. The upper head temperature modification is to address basically a materials reliability issue in the industry with regards to vessel head penetration cracking. And that's a temperature dependent issue. And so by lowering the temperature of the vessel head, it improves the reliability of those materials of the head material.
Is that accomplished by just getting more flow into the upper head?
Basically, both of these modifications involve actually drilling new flow holes in the reactor internals and plugging existing flow holes to redirect the flow characteristics external to the core. Pinning assembly that attaches the guide tube support assemblies to the upper internals, and there's a issue in the industry of these pins breaking. And that becomes an issue for, once again, a loose parts concern in the reactor coolant system if one of these pins were to break and have loose pieces. We don't have any of those right now, but we're going to preemptively, before that could happen to us, go in there and replace these pins. Once again, significant work in the refueling cavity on the upper internals.
This was done in Unit 1 a few outages ago.
Right, 1R9. We completed this in Unit 1.
So the industry knows what's causing the pins to break?
Yes, and I not knowing, I'd have to get the subject matter experts to explain that to you accurately.
Yeah.
But I believe it's a materials issue with the construction of the pins.
Yeah. Okay.
Steam generator N-1 replacement activities. What's that mean? That, well, 2R14 is when we're going to do our steam generator replacement activities. So this is our last chance to go in and do design verification activities for the steam generator replacements in 2R14. What this doesn't involve is physical modifications to the plant. Some plants that do steam generator replacements do quite a bit of modifications in the preceding outage, you know, obstruction removal type of activities. This, for us, is the major scope here is laser photography, photogrammetry, they call it, to basically do a three-dimensional mapping, computerized three-dimensional mapping of all the equipment, and it's very precise to be able to use that mapping for design documentation and specification of the exact details of the design. There's also a significant amount of engineering walk-down activities to basically just go out there and resolve a myriad of questions and issues that need to be resolved in order to make sure we have an excellent plan for implementation in the subsequent refueling outage. Why I say that's significant is it's a lot of work in the vicinity of the steam generators themselves. You have to be in the field to do this stuff. And so we will be looking for ALARA planning on in this activity, because we need to get the work done. There's no doubt about it. We need to be successful in our next outage by doing the work this outage that we need to do. But as an outage manager, I get real worried about a lot of engineering walk-down activities that I don't have a feel for exactly what are you going to go look at, and do you have an objective when you go out in the field that you can tell me you can go in and get it and come out and be successful. So we have a lot of we have a lot of planning and verification of that planning for this activity. The other thing, of course, is this work needs to be done when the condition there's no other obstructions in the area around the steam generators, because obviously the laser mapping won't help too much if you've got scaffolds and other things in the way.
Just an associated steam generator question. I have to believe that somebody is tracking the events at Palo Verde Unit 1 resulting from their steam generator replacements in that unit and their vibration problem, and of course they're limited at this moment to 25% power. So I'm not suggesting that there's a relationship between what you have and what they have, but it just seems to me that there's some experience out there to be gained that may or may not be helpful to you.
I agree with that.
Okay.
And I know the project team is very well aware of that.
I'm
don't
sure
know what
they
the actions are to address it at this time.
Seeing as how they're next door. Huh?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Last one that I'll point out is a significant change from 1R13 is we are upgrading the digital controls of our feed water system to the steam generators. So it's once again, this is the digital controls. It's not the actual reg valves and controls in the field. Actual implementation, I think we have a real good plan for implementing this, once again, this is more from a nervousness of making sure that it works properly on startup and not inducing a problem that could cause us trouble in the future.
So having said that, there's somebody really looking hard at the post-modification testing on this particular system.
We have a readiness review board scheduled that we're going to dig into that completely, because I don't know the answer to that, but I'm going to find out.
Be tough.
Yeah. Next slide. These are a lot of other significant scope items that we're doing that are similar to what we did in 1R13.
What is the scope of the LP terminal? I didn't think you were replacing the low pressure terminal on unit number 2, but you are replacing. Same thing as
LP. In this case, with respect to high pipe testing, and I wondered whether that was. Well, I just wondered why.
I guess I'll say I'm not prepared to answer that question.
Well, I just saw it on your list, so I thought it was a good time to inject it.
Okay.
it just seemed rather strange to me that you base replacement to a large extent on high pipe testing, but you don't suggest in the LER that you're going to continue to do anything further.
And I'll verify what I'm about to say, but I believe 1R13 was the outage where we were going to correlate the HIPOT testing with the cables that we pull out and look at actual degradation of the older cables, correlate to HIPOT, and then use HIPOT going forward to make sure we prioritize cable replacements. And I'll verify what I just said and get back to you if it's anything different.
Yeah,
our plan is to continue cable replacements for all the vital buses going forward.
Yeah, and you just say that.
Yeah.
I just wondered whether the timing was such with respect to replacement that you didn't see a need to do further high pot testing downstream between now, or I should say then, 1R13, and the schedule for replacement certain certain cable.
Yeah, jogger memory cell.
No, what Dave said is true. We did 3 as-found HiPods, and specifically for the purpose of validating that our plan for replacements was valid on a technical basis due to the degradation of the cables.
And we'll continue. We'll do HiPods in the future, and now we'll have a correlation between the as-found and HiPods, and
gotcha.
We'll get more accurate indication.
I kind of thought that was probably what you were doing. It just wasn't stated that in that manner, so it was fuzzy to me.
Thank you.
Okay, this next slide, I put this in here in case I saw an hour and it seemed like a long time, so I put it in here in case we ran out of things to talk about. Outage management is really engaged in, you know, trying to improve our performance, and so this is a list of some of the things, some of the initiatives we're going after. I think if you guys want to pull the string on some fact-finding in the future, we'll be happy to discuss this with you. But I think we best keep you on schedule by moving through the next few slides and get right to the safety plan, unless the team wants to pull the string on any of these other items. The committee?
Anybody?
No.
Okay.
Okay, Brad.
Safety plan. Per our outage milestones, we will have our safety plan and schedule to our PSRC on March 17th, and we're on track to do that. The vertical slice reviews that I referred to earlier that we want to have as predecessors for our safety schedule validation are going to occur not next week but the week after, and will be have us on track for completing the safety schedule review that we have scheduled on the 7th of March. So we're on track. The safety plan itself, we did a fairly significant rewrite of that last outage, not changing the criteria, but making it a more operator user-friendly tool. Got a lot of great feedback from operations. They definitely liked the new format better. They found it a much more usable tool for them. And as an outage manager, I love that operations are looking at the safety plan. That's exactly the focus we need them to have. And,
right.
And so we're on track for the 2R13 safety plan. I can tell you right now, it's going to look very similar to 1R13 in that our plan for implementation of the outage looks very similar to 1R13 with regards to safety equipment configuration status. And key to that is that we have no need to plan for a hot loop activity prior to core unload. Our steam generator work is off critical path, and we have every opportunity to put the nozzle dams in to support primary eddy current testing after the core is unloaded while we're doing the other activities in the reactor cavity. We will be able to get those nozzle dams out before we reload the core. And so the only mid-loop activity that we will be performing during the outage would be for the vacuum refill of our RCS system after we got tension ahead. Aside from that, there are no unusual safety significant risk items that I would expect would put us in a unexpected or undesirable defense in depth position or high risk profile condition.
Just one more query on your color chart.
Yeah.
Did you say something about the red block?
Sure. We are behind on our schedule development. And schedule is a tool that you have to use for successful implementation for an outage, so there's no compromise on the quality of that schedule. So we were supposed to issue a quality Rev Zero schedule on January 20th, and didn't.
And I suspect you can respond to this. But, back in at a PSRC meeting in September, there was discussion on action taking on peer checking, particularly with respect to clearances, and you did a change procedurally so that certain peer checks were not required to be done. And I was looking at the quality verification assessment of the October 23 to November 2nd time frame, and their statement: through the first 2 windows of the outage, 5 noteworthy errors occurred. 3 involved clearance work. And I guess my question really to you is, do you think that the relaxation, bad word, the diminution, if you will, of the necessity to peer check a certain percentage of clearances, for example, might have been the cause of this, or do you know why the clearance errors occurred?
One, I don't know why, because I haven't been involved in that root cause. But I can tell you that I have not heard from operations, who has the lead on that cause analysis,
yeah,
any correlation between the procedural requirements and the errors that occur.
Yeah.
Maybe I can add some information here. I mentioned earlier that we saw some mispositions in operations, and clearance errors certainly can be categorized as that.
Yeah.
And we instituted a change to our verification program when paying clearances to match that of the industry. We had a practice of two operators going out concurrently, one manipulating the valve or taking the action as part of the clearance, and then the second one verifying that it's correct. They'd be there the same place, same time.
Mm.
And industry standards are you separate those two in place and time, so the second operator wouldn't get tricked, if you will, by going to the wrong place.
Yes.
And in changing it, the station, we wanted to try to keep two people together for safety purposes for that initial valve or initial configuration change and follow up with a second independent person, so it would be three people for every clearance point. And we dry ran that through the summer of 2005, and the change you're referring to is to remove that second person on the initial movement of the device.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have one operator going out, self-verifying, making the change, and then the second operator independently coming to check on it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the diminution aspect, if you will. So we're in line with the industry. And I do believe by having two people separated in time and space provides better independent verification. However, it did not materially impact our error rate. And so, like we're saying, we're going back around and go, why is that?
Okay.
We're meeting industry standard. It's best practice that we know of, and what else we need to be doing. And that's the cause analysis you mentioned.
Well, I think the change you made, I don't think there's anything wrong with the change you made. I think you did the right thing in that regard. I just wondered whether that had, or whatever change you made, had an impact on the fact that you're still seeing, I'll just focus now on clearance errors, because I'm sure that's something big on your mind, being the outage manager.
Well, certainly as an outage manager, any error is a negative impact on productivity of the organization.
And so safety. And the safety.
Safety.
That's right. And safety of the organization.
Yeah.
Exactly. They're all interrelated. Excellent performance includes all of those factors.
Yeah. Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. So I don't think it, what happens didn't make it any better. We don't think it made it any worse.
I see.
But we need to figure out what else do we need to do to make it better.
Okay.
You're still a victim of small number statistics on this. It's,
yeah, but beginning with clearance issues, you really want
to. You don't want any of them, I know. Brad, thank you for a very informative report. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, next up is Bob Height. Bob is our manager of radiation protection at Dabble Canyon. He's going to talk about the 1R13 collective radiation exposure performance, although it might say LR there.
All right, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Brian. All right, I'm going to open up this with a bit of a preamble. 1R13 was a pretty challenging outage from a radiation exposure standpoint. You see the acronym CRE, that's collective radiation exposure. We went into this outage with a pretty aggressive scope and a lot of either first-time or very infrequently performed radiologically significant activities. So your first slide that you see lists a number of those, and the numbers that you see next to those activities are the estimated dose on the left side and the actual dose received on the right side. A 10-year reactor vessel in-service inspection, that's a significant activity. There are a lot of people involved, and they're very close to the reactor refueling cavity. So that's very infrequently performed. We did get very close to our estimate on that. The reactor coolant pump impeller, and it did come in under its estimate. Thermocouple cable modification, that's another one that was first time. It wasn't as significant a dose as some of the others, but it was one that we watched very closely. Containment fan cooler unit drain line replacement, that hasn't been done before. the RHR valve modification, the vessel flange and stud hole inspections, and the valve switch replacements. Those are all, again, first-time evolutions. So it was a fairly aggressive scope outage in addition to the normal routine maintenance. Included also in the dose for the outage, we had some emergent scope that was a significant dose. Next up, letdown heat exchanger line weld repair. That was estimated at 1.83 rem, person rem, and came in at 1.28 person rem. That was a significant job because it's in a very it's in a high dose rate area, and that's very infrequently accessed. So we put an aggressive goal at 1.83 rem on that and challenged the group involved to bring that in lower, and they did bring it in lower. So that job went very well. RCP stator replacement, that's a result of inspections. We had to replace that. That job came in well. And the other emergent scope, about two-person rem, that's a lot of just various activities that we track as emergent scope. So when you look at the first slide and the second slide, you've got about 20 or 21 rem of unusual or emergent scope in addition to the normal refueling scope that we do every outage. Looking at the goal generation, every outage, we take a look at what the plan scope is and look at how we've performed historically on that plan scope and come up with estimates based on the history and some knowledge of what we're going to do differently or better for the upcoming outage. So the original estimate that going into the outage was at 132 person rem. The previous best performance for Unit 1 was 136 rem. So this estimate was bringing us in, even with an aggressive scope, we had an estimate lower than our previous best. We did decide to set a goal lower than that, and you see the goal based on the full INPO collective radiation exposure index points. INPO measures performance in various areas and assigns points, basically, for how well you perform that add up to 100 if you're doing everything and meeting all the industry goals. ALARA is one place where we don't meet the industry goal and of getting all the points available. We wanted to strive to get that achieved in this outage. So we set a goal at 100 rem. So you see a pretty big delta between the estimate and the goal. Going into the outage, we were expecting a similar reduction in dose rates that we'd seen the previous outage due to the use of some special resins and cleanup processes. We ended up, and that's about a 20% decrease. The 132 rem did not include a 20% decrease. The 100 rem counted on that, and we're going to see what the results are coming out of that. Some of the initiatives that we implemented to go after this aggressive 100 rem goal. Our radiation work permit, ALARA leads. That's a program where we assign managers and directors to have specific oversight of areas where they have technical expertise. You know, a lot of the managers and a lot of the directors have dealt in their past with the various activities, whether it's in-service inspection or valve work or pump work, reactor refueling. So all those activities that have high dose, we assign managers and directors to have day-to-day in-field and with the supervisor oversight of those jobs to provide basically more visibility and show that there is management interest in bringing the dose to the staff down. All containment entries require to breathe. We stepped up our before a person could get into the auxiliary building or into the containment building. In the past outages, all those entries didn't require a brief, so people could bypass the RP access control briefing process and go directly to work. We pulled that in last outage and spent a lot more time discussing dose reduction techniques, asked the workers to tell us how they were going to get their radiation exposure reduced on that specific entry. So we put a lot more emphasis right at the point of entry to engage the workers in being interested in reducing their exposure. Fewer radiation protection technicians in containment. That's been an ongoing process. Over the years, we're seeing fewer and fewer technicians in the industry available to us for outages, and so we have an ongoing review process and basically process changes to deal with fewer technicians by implementing newer technologies and other ways of doing business for the technicians. You see the PRC01 resin. That is a new resin that we tried the first time in 1R12, and we have implemented it again in 1R13. That's specifically designed to remove ultrafine particulates during the reactor water cleanup process to bring the dose rates down. And you see a demineralizer, and that says lead. That should be let down filter plan. This was the first outage where we actually had a formal document that went through a review and approval process that made sure we did all the elements for the reactor water cleanup process as we wanted to do. In the past, that's been somewhat informal, really valuable for our own people to be able to go to other sites and see how other people do business and bring back good ideas. So we continue to pursue that, and I expect at some point we will be able to do more of that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So some of the results that we saw. Basically, the cleanup, we did not get the result we were hoping, which was a 20% reduction in general area dose rates from the previous outage. We saw 0 to 5% reduction in general areas down from 1R12, but there was 0% reduction around the reactor head. The reactor head, even though we shield it heavily, sits in a fairly open location for a lot of people. It sits right where the people go into the containment, and it's a significant source contributor to a lot of activities that go on the refuel deck. So that was a disappointment. One of the things we're looking at is we had a down power 30 days prior to the outage for an ocean swell condition. Whenever we do these down powers, we get introduction of radioactive material into the coolant at higher levels than if we're steady state operation. So that's one of the issues that we'll be looking at more as well to see if that did contribute to that, because we did expect a 20% reduction and didn't get it, and the head is a significant contributor.
Do you normally see a significant crud burst, if any, when you shut?
Yes.
You do?
We do. Basically, the process is, as we shut down, the EPRI has very tightly controlled processes that plants have adopted, including Diablo Canyon. And what that comes down to is we set the coolant up in a condition that when we introduce oxygen into the primary coolant, that does release crud. That is a controlled evolution. It is an expected crud burst, and we have the letdown cleanup strategies are in place to clean that up so that they don't get onto the pipes. Basically, that crud burst will occur whether you do it in a controlled fashion or don't. So as soon as oxygen is introduced into the system, it will occur. Mm-hmm. So we go through this entire cleanup process to make sure it's removed prior to putting people to work in the areas where they would be affected.
Bob, are other plants similar to Diablo or same vintage, are they seeing 20% reductions from one refueler to another?
It's varied throughout the industry. What we're doing is we're implementing this. We're very systematically implementing these resins in our cleanup process in a more scientific, I'll call it, fashion. We're using one type of resin in one unit and a different type in another unit and evaluating the effectiveness of both. See which one works better. No one else has gone after getting a good systematic evaluation of how well these resins perform. So not everyone's using the resins either. So it's there's no clean answer to your question other than some see it, some don't.
I think, you know, if you ask the question differently, is 20% a reasonable expectation? I think based on industry data, Bob, do you think that 20% was a reasonable expectation?
Based on our regimen for the cleanup, it is.
But you're not going to be able to continue that outage after outage, though. You're going to peak out at some point in time.
Well, level out.
Level out. Yeah,
you're down in the noise again.
We would expect it to level over time. Yes, that's right.
What are you expecting for Unit 2 outage coming up?
We're expecting the same.
20%
to see a reduction, yes.
Okay.
Now, this crud burst that you saw a couple weeks before the shutdown. Do you see it when you shut down anyway?
Yes. You see crud released as you cool down. You affect the fuel releases crud as you cool down as a natural part of the cool down process. Yes.
And what's the difference in the species you see? Are you still looking at the same stuff? It can't be hour and a half lives. It's longer than that.
There are chemical differences. In the controlled shutdowns that we do, we put this particulate matter under conditions that render it soluble that we don't do when we do a down power.
Ah.
So it is a different evolution. And so when we send the coolant then through demineralizers on a regular shutdown, it's removed. on a down power, like we do for these ocean swells, it's released as a particulate, and demineralizers don't take that out as efficiently. So
the rate of nuclei distribution is comparable, you know,
yes.
Well, 58, 60 primarily, but the chemical form is in.
Yeah, interesting.
So the whole purpose of the shutdown process is to put it in a form that we can efficiently remove in a quick period of time, so that it doesn't have a chance to play it out on the piping and the valves.
Well, you should be out of the storm season for 2R13, right?
We are, yes.
Good luck.
Okay. So, next slide. So, the results for the outage. Again, going back, we had the 132 experienced workers. As we bring in inexperienced workers, it typically causes the job to go longer, and this is an example of where we see additional dose as a result of using inexperienced workers. That's something we watch closely. We do strive to get experienced workers, especially on the higher dose rate jobs, so that we can get them in, get the job done right, and get them out with the lowest exposure possible. But in some cases, it's not always possible.
Maybe you should define what you mean by inexperienced. That's
yes.
Sort of a global term, and it doesn't really clarify what it is I think you mean.
Yes. As you look around the industry, there are it's not just Diablo Canyon, but the whole industry has people that have been performing, coming into the outages year after year after year, doing the same basic work year after year after year. So they are very knowledgeable of techniques that they can use to lower their own exposure. But in all cases, that knowledge isn't transferred to new workers. These are still experienced mechanics. They're experienced INC people. They're well qualified to do the work, but they don't have some of the nuances that have been learned over time by the really experienced people. So that is something that we're actively taking on now to get some of that experience down on paper and into planning documents so the people coming in the future will be able to take advantage of it. And that's something that we're going to have to go after aggressively, because if you look at the demographics throughout the entire industry, that will become more and more of an issue. So that is an aggressive activity that we have here to get that documented so we take advantage of it in the future with the newer people.
Thanks. That's a very helpful explanation. Thank you.
So that was the bulk of the information that I brought in. So I was going to open it up to questions at this point.
I've asked mine.
I actually, that was quite informative. I do not have a single question.
Professor, I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
And Bill says he's finished. Jim or Sheila? Vernon.
No further questions.
Well, I think your lecture was right on target.
Very good.
Even the professor agrees.
Yeah, I can give a lecture, too, if you want. Wouldn't be on this topic, though.
Well, Bob, that was great. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
What's your pleasure? We're a few minutes early. We could take a stretch now. And
Mr.
Take a
Chairman, stretch. Our next presenter is not here at this time.
He's not even scheduled here for a few minutes. Why don't we take 15 minutes and relax and then come back to work?
Okay.
Well, pending the arrival.
Thank you.
Okay. We never get back on time anyway. Okay, I think we're ready. Okay, we'll reconvene. Since this isn't really the beginning of a session, I don't have to read the standard text. But if there is anybody from the public who would like to say anything at this point, I'd be glad to recognize them. No? Doug? No? Okay, then. Dave, it's yours again.
Okay, thank you. Under tab 3, we have two presentations. The first one is by Mike Leger on the Raptor head inspection, and then it'll be followed by Dave Gonzalez on the Raptor vessel in service inspection. So, Mike.
Thank you, Dave. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
This afternoon, we'll be discussing the 1R13 reactor top head inspections. To give you a recap of where the requirements come from, NRC Order EA03009, which was revised in February of 04, specifies the inspection requirements for PWR. In order to support the volumetric examination, we were required to modify our headstand and raise it up to allow access for the robots that must fit under the head to position the inspection equipment. In addition to that, the shield ring, which is also part of the headstand, was required to be raised in order to lower the dose to workers around the head periphery. The primary examination technique used for reactor head penetrations is time-of-flight diffraction ultrasonics. That's a volumetric technique that interrogates the entire wall of the tubes. That is also supplemented by an eddy current technique, which is sensitive to surface breaking flaws on the inside of the tube. Our examination vendor previously demonstrated their detection capabilities on the EPRI reactor head penetration mock-ups. There's a protocol, an industry and EPRI-derived protocol that they use to demonstrate their abilities. Recently, right before our 1R13 refueling outage, the vendor underwent additional qualification activities under their own accord in order to extend the ability to detect indications near the very end of the tube, which was previously undemonstrated. All data acquisition is performed remotely by computer-controlled robots at some distance from the containment. Next slide. This schematic shows the reactor vessel head sitting. This being the head itself, sitting on its stand. This is a stand. The dashed lines here on this portion of the stand indicate the raised portion of the headstand, that the modification that we made in order to raise it so this robotic device could fit underneath the head penetration tubes. This dashed line here represents the new shield wall that prevents the radiation from exiting underneath the head, or lowers the dose from the radiation underneath the head to the workers around the head. This schematic also shows the four main types of head penetration tubes. Out on the periphery, we have what are called thermocouple columns or instrument ports. We have CRDM penetration tubes. These are control rod drive mechanisms, and they have what's called a thermal sleeve and a funnel on the end of the thermal sleeve. We have what we call spare penetrations, which are open housings, and they're called open because there's nothing inside. And adjacent to that, we have what's called a part length drive, and this is a part length drive shaft sticking out of it. At the bottom, we have a depiction of the robot in several different positions where it would be inspecting the CRDM or the head penetration tubes. Next slide.
Mike, would you mind, sometimes one of us will ask a question that we think
might be of interest to our visitors or to people who might watch the television of this meeting. We're acquainted with the fact that there's radiation coming from this head. I wonder if you could say a couple more words about why, where it comes from, and what it is you're protecting people against.
The reactor head during operation is exposed to flux from the reactor core. Some of the components inside the reactor become activated, and they become radiation sources themselves. So there is a fairly high source of radiation underneath the head here from 5 to 6 R per hour, which is a considerable amount of radiation. So we need to provide protection to the workers who have to access the head for various projects, not only this project, but other surrounding work on the 140 refueling deck. And this new shield wall lowers that dose down to very low levels. So when the head is in place on the stand, there's very low radiation levels adjacent to the head outside.
And this radiation is coming from what elements?
Excuse me?
Cobalt, nickel?
That's out of my area of expertise, but yes, that actually the components themselves can be irradiated, and the probe has to be able to be slid in between the outside of this thermal sleeve, which is close to the same diameter as the inside of the head penetration tube. So it's rather challenging. The gap that the probe has to work with is on the order of an eighth of an inch. The probe itself is about a tenth of an inch thick. We have some additional pictures to show close-ups of what they look like. Next slide. This is one of the Diablo Canyon headstands as it sits ready for the head to be set in place right prior to headset. The robot is installed and sitting in the center of the headstand. It has a vertical mast and a horizontal arm with some axes of control, various axes. And this is the end effector here. This particular end effector is for open housing, so it's rather large. Those are the easiest type of tubes to inspect. There's also various other support equipment like cameras to observe the position of the robot, verify that which penetration we're examining. The headstand is covered in Herculite plastic, so it's a little hard to see, but this is the extended portion of the headstand for the support of these exams. Actually, this is the shield ring, excuse me. The stand, the support stand for the head is over here. This is a doorway on the lower portion here, bounded by the white, is a doorway in the shield ring. What that allows is the robot to be positioned and driven through that door so the end effector can be changed on the robot for the various types of tubes that are going to be inspected, the different end effectors that are required to be used. Next slide. This slide is the electronic, it's a little dark here on this display system, but it's the electronic support equipment for the robot control. It serves as the interface between the fiber optic cables that carry the control commands from the trailers that are several hundred yards outside the containment, and serves as the interface between that and the robot, which is underneath the head, which is right behind here. You can't really see it. The picture's a little dark. But the system also receives the examination data from the inspection head, digitizes that data, converts it into a light signal, and sends it back across those same fiber optic cables out to the trailers, where the data is there recorded and saved for analysis later.
Mike, what is the setup time on this system?
It takes about 2.5 days to set up all the equipment underneath and the electronic equipment to verify their calibrations and go through their checkouts. It's quite a load of equipment. They show up with small sea trains and huge steel boxes and it takes cranes to transport this equipment over to the area. Some of it's quite heavy. This is a photo of an open housing end effector. It's the largest of the end effectors, and it has spring-loaded sleds. This is an ultrasonic sled here. These are the time-of-flight diffraction transducers that we mentioned earlier. On the opposite side would be a similar-looking sled with eddy current probes in it. Ready. This is an end effector used for the penetration tubes that have thermal sleeves. So this is a more difficult access end effector for the tubes. These rollers that you see here are positioned on the back side of the thermal sleeve. They hold it. And then there's a shoe on the near side that the end effector slides up and goes up into the gap between the thermal sleeve and the tube. This device is capable of actually grabbing the tube and slightly moving it over so there's more room for the blade probe to slide up in there. It's also capable of holding the tube, which is free to rotate in the head by design. And as the end effector scans around, it rotates the tube in the funnel with it. This is all to make sure we can get up into this tight gap and do the exams. Some plants have had difficulty getting full coverage. In the inspection head, which is the Lucite part, there are two time of flight transducers and two eddy current probes, as well as a zero degree ultrasonic probe for the various exams. It also carries a couplant feed tube. Ultrasonics requires a coupling medium between the transducer and the tube itself. It's pretty high tech. These probes are made in Sweden and they're rather expensive. The exam result from 1R13, we looked at all 80 of our penetrations volumetrically. That includes the 53 CRDM penetrations with thermal sleeves, our 13 spares that are the open housing with the larger end effector, the 5 thermocouple columns, those are open housing with that same larger end effector, 8 part links, 7 of those have drive shaft. That requires also a special shoe to go in and back up the blade probe. It's an even different inspection head configuration. And the 1-inch head vent. During our exams, we did not detect any indications of primary water stress corrosion cracking. We did, however, have a few tubes that had limitations to the required 1-inch examination zone. The NRC order requires area of 1 inch of the tube to be examined below the lowest point of the weld. In some cases at Diablo Canyon, there's physically not enough tube below the weld to get the 1 inch. So in those particular locations, we worked with our vendor or the supplier of the head, and we did analysis of those particular locations of the as-built configurations, did stress analysis, fracture mechanics, and we presented those results to the NRC, and they in turn granted us relief from that 1-inch inspection requirement. There were 7 tubes where that was applicable.
Is that a one-time relief?
No, they granted that relief from now on.
Is this similar to other plants or others?
Yes.
Not have the... They do. They have the same
yes,
problem.
Yes, very, very similar. There are many plants that have a similar relief request. Because of the vendor's additional qualification activities in the lower part of the tubes, our coverages were greater in Unit 1 than they were in our first Unit 2 exam. So we've gone to some extra effort. We had a lot fewer tubes in our relief request this time. We'll be using that same technology, of course, again in Unit 2 to get the greater coverage. We've always been able to see things there. Just now it's proven that they can see things there by the demonstration activities. If this doesn't put you to sleep, we'll go over it briefly. This is a sample of what a UT analyst might see back in the trailer. The lower portion of the slide here represents the tube, one vertical slice of the tube. There are 180 of these, in other words, 180 scans, vertical scans in the tube. On the left is the bottom of the tube. This is the top of the tube, or end of the scan, excuse me. In this case, it's about an 8-inch long scan. In the center here is the weld area. So if you take 180 of these and you stack them up side by side, you would end up with this top display up here. And this green area represents the weld. The reason it's curved is the weld is at a varying distance from the end of the tube, which is the bottom of this display, is the bottom end of the tube. So the weld is at a varying distance from the end of the tube because of the slope of the head. Next slide. This is just a quick shot in case you're curious of what an indication might look like, a real type indication. It's a calibration scan that the vendor does to check probes and instrument settings to make sure that everything is correct. And in this case, you can see these are notches in a tube that's very similar to one of the tubes in the head. And there's a small, a medium, and a larger OD flaws in the tube, simulated flaws. And they produce these, what we call echodynamic curves here, that are fairly easy to spot. Next slide. In addition to the volumetric exams, we perform a bare metal visual exams. Those exams are performed in-house by PG&E personnel. This is the second time we've done it. We participated in the design of this robot. It has magnets in its underbelly to help maintain traction as it crawls across the slope of the head. It has a 4 camera that is focusable and can tilt, and adjustable lights, and also a rear camera for inspection as well, and which aids in navigation. Any questions?
Yeah. If this vendor with this equipment had been available at the Davis-Bessey plant to look at the underside of their head, would they have found that great big hole?
The answer to that question is yes, because that's how Davis-Bessey found that indication. They did not find it doing bare metal visuals on top of the head. In their first volumetric exam, they found these cracks existing in the tubes. And that's what led them to do the further investigations and found the gaping hole on the outside of their head. But the detection was actually the cracks in the tubes themselves, which lead to the head degradation over time. Davis-Bessey had problems in their tubes presumably for a number of cycles before it was detected, but it was their first volumetric exam.
Okay, thank you.
Bill? Do you do the same thing on unit number 2 during 2 or 13?
Yes, we'll be performing volumetric and bare metal examinations each refueling outages until we replace our heads, if we decide to do so.
After the heads are replaced, then what sort of inspections are required?
The new heads, the tubes in the new heads would be made of a different material. It's a different alloy that is much more resistant to cracking than this alloy 600 and 690.
Mm-hmm.
So The inspection requirements initially require you to do a pre-service inspection, and then there's a longer inspection frequency, a longer time between inspections due to the different material characteristics.
Like 12 equivalent years?
I can't say exactly, but I believe like 7 years, maybe Dave.
Yes.
7 years might be.
Mm-hmm. Fern? Anything? That's very interesting.
I might add before we go on, PG&E board this afternoon did approve our request to replace both the reactor vessel heads on our unit. So those are scheduled for 2009-2010.
Are there any issues with getting in queue around other reactor vessel fabrication work that's going to be happening, or are you going to be in early enough?
We're going to be in early enough because I paid last year a sum of money to get ourselves in the queue with the worldwide demand for not only replacement reactor vessels and new reactors. There was a sweet spot out there that we were able to grab a couple of spots and hold them pending our board approval today. So we've got it. We've got a place with Japan Steel Works.
Japan Steel, okay. So these will be forged from a single piece of metal?
That's right.
Oh.
Good show, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next up is Dave Gonzalez. Continue the discussion, but now it's on the reactor vessel itself, our 10-year service inspection.
Good afternoon. I'm Dave Gonzalez, and I'm going to talk to you this afternoon regarding another aspect of our in-service inspection in 1R13, and that's the reactor vessel inspection, the inspection of the reactor vessel forging itself, shells itself. The American Society of Mechanical Engineers Code, the Section 11 code that's titled Rules for In-Service Inspection of Nuclear Power Plant Components, specifies examinations on a prescribed frequency for the reactor vessel shell and internal structures. The reactor vessel, as you know, is fabricated of carbon manganese plates that are welded together, and these range in thickness from about 11 inches thick on this upper shell course area to about 5 inches thick on the lower section, on the lower head. And the ASME code requires ultrasonic examination of all the welds on the reactor vessel proper and the nozzle attachments to the main coolant loops where there are dissimilar metal welds as it attaches to the reactor coolant system. These examinations are required once every 10 years. It's a big evolution because, as you'll see later, we have to remove the lower internals. And it's required in a 10-year frequency, and it was scheduled to be conducted. It also allows us access to the outside of the core support structure, this core barrel, that would not normally be available. So we're looking at this cutaway view next. Next slide. This is a better illustration. This cutaway view, as I indicated, shows not only the internal structures, but I've highlighted some of the welds here. You can see there are welds around the nozzles themselves, where all 8 nozzles are welded to the vessel. There's circumferential welds on the 3 shell courses, where the shell courses are welded together. You'll see I've illustrated welds here, and welds on the bottom to the bottom head. And there's also vertical welds in the each shell course. So there's 3 vertical welds. Newer vessels are fabricated without vertical welds. They only have circumferential welds. But our vintage does have vertical welds.
There's 3 welds around the periphery? There's vertical welds?
Though? That is correct. They're full penetration, full volume welds in each shell course. So each ring segment is made up of 3 individual segments that were welded together. The upper shell course, as I indicated, is about 11 inches thick, and the lower ones are much thinner. They're about 8 to 9 inches thick. Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's carbon manganese steel. And this was the technology when these were fabricated back then. So these examinations are conducted underwater with remotely controlled inspection robots. The robots are programmed to position these ultrasonic transducers, similar to the ones that Mike discussed, with somewhat slightly different functions and different sizes, that's for sure, because we're examining something much larger. These transducer arrays are placed on the vessel surface, and they interrogate the weld and base materials, searching for indications of defects. So effectively, they they function as sonar, and they're attuned to looking for specific types of reflectors. The ultrasonic examination procedures and personnel undergo an internationally recognized series of tests to demonstrate that they are capable of performing these examinations with their personnel, with their equipment, and with the procedures that they're specified to use on our vessel. Similar to the head inspection, the data acquisition is via fiber optic link to the data analysis office, another trailer outside, where it's digitally recorded and allowed to be, and that it is archived for future reference. This was actually our third full vessel examination. We had conducted an examination pre-service, prior to placing the component in service. We conducted another examination after the first 10 years of operation, and now this is our second in-service inspection after 20 years of operation. And this allows us to trend the weld characteristics over time, and the analysts had access to the previously recorded data and were able to compare previous indications to current indications. So these qualified ultrasonic data analysts review all the data per procedural requirements. Next slide, please.
Has there been a lot of change and improvement in the technology for doing this since 10 years ago?
Yes, actually the technology has changed. For one thing, the transducers are more sophisticated. The acquisition systems, of course, are a lot more sophisticated. I mean, once upon a time you needed air conditioners to keep the data, the equipment cool, and now it's all done with laptops, essentially. Of course, it has a very large control system inside containment to control the robots. But these robots are actually fairly universal in application. They were originally designed for steam generator bowl inspections, but they've been modified to and adapted to do reactor vessel examinations. And they're even in some configurations they're used to do reactor head examinations, as Mike discussed earlier. Now, we did not use these robots for a reactor head, and there was a availability and their previous demonstrations led us to use an actual different technology on a reactor head. But these robots here, I have two of them in this photograph, and this is actually not from our unit. This is from the Wolf Creek Nuclear Station, where we went in preparation for our examination to look at the logistics to support our exam. You see two robots here on screen. Here's one robot, and here's another, its sister robot. Here's a ultrasonic transducer array, and positioned on this upper robot. Each one has six axes of freedom. These robots are then attached to either a lower platform where you can see assembled, and we'll see a cutaway with them installed in the reactor vessel, the lower inspection platform and an upper inspection platform. So both robots can run simultaneously inspecting different areas of the reactor vessel. Next slide, please. So this is a little dark, this illustration here, but here shows a typical application. What we would see here is a lower platform installed on the core support lugs that align the core barrel, the lower internal structure that we had shown was being removed from the reactor vessel, with a lower robot inspecting the bottom head and lower sections of the reactor vessel in this position. The lower robot to ascertain that if there are any flaws, are there any flaws in the weld or any flaws growing out of the weld into the adjoining base metal. You can see here is transducer arrays placed on the reactor vessel surface with their angle beams, with the different sound beams showing the limits of the inspection on either side of that weld. And here are some coordinates that the robot would use to develop its pre-programmed positions to affect 100% examination of these wells, as allowed by the geometry of the reactor vessel. Like I noted, there's core support lugs, there's bottom-mounted instrumentation tubes, and there's nozzle openings that would preclude examination of some small areas. Next slide. Now here's a photograph of a robot control screen. This robot operator would be looking at these parameters, all these parameters on screen, and this one illustrates the robot performing an examination of our bottom-mounted instrumentation tubes. This is a lower robot, and it has its end effector going into one of our 58 lower bottom-mounted instrumentation tubes to inspect those. As you recall, we have Alloy 600 components not only in our top head, but we have alloy 600 components on our dissimilar metal wells and our bottom mounted instrumentation tubes. And you recall South Texas Power Plant had an indication in this one area. Now, currently, it's not an NRC required examination, but we are proactively taking this opportunity to inspect and to ascertain their health, to verify, and this is a good opportunity to do so while a core barrel is removed.
Have there been any other cases like the South Texas one?
There have been no known leakers elsewhere. I do believe there have been some indications of fabrication discontinuities, but nothing that has leaked externally.
Is that correct?
Yeah. So I believe most units are taking the opportunity to inspect. It's an industry-driven initiative.
How did South Texas end up repairing that bad tube? Did they plug it, or what?
No, I believe they recovered it. The welding, the repair process, as I recall, they used dams to remove the water from the area. Of course, the entire unit has to be flood. The entire vessel has to remain flooded because of its high radiation. They used dams to do that. They removed from underneath the vessel. They have access underneath the vessel. They bored out most of the tube. They affected a new weld from the alloy 600 to the carbon steel material down below, and then added a new section of tube down below that. So it was a kind of a learn while you go experience for them, and it was very costly, but they were able to recover the use of that tube.
It was very ingenious, too.
It was indeed. So there was a number of vendors that participated in getting this industry problem resolved.
Yeah, because I think I remember after it was discovered, but before they fixed it, discussion about whether it was actually physically possible to do affect that kind of repair and whether this was a very serious problem from a financial standpoint.
That's correct.
Indeed. Indeed. As a matter of fact, and it was found late in the routage. They were doing examinations, just a visual examination. So this attests to the quality and to the necessity of visual examinations, mm-hmm. where they found a very small amount, just grams of boric acid exuding from two tubes. And there was something that was different in the nature of that manufacturer of those areas that caused that leak, because no others had been found.
That must have been an extended outage, too, though.
It did extend their outage, yes. Right. They had to unload. Their core was loaded. They had reloaded their core. They were on their way back to reassembling the plant after the outage.
It was a good catch, then.
Yeah, it was a good catch. So their inspection engineers found that. Next slide.
Dave.
Yes, sir.
Are you using TV cameras to position the robots, or are you using measurements that you knew ahead of time?
They're actually digital measurements. It's all digital. There's all robot positions. Have to each axis interfaces with the other axis to achieve the location of a point in space, in this case, a particular azimuth and elevation in the reactor vessel to examine a specific weld. There's a lot of programming that goes into that robot position, so all axes are functioning such that the transducers have the proper contact with that area and maintain that proper contact and maintain the proper scan parallel to the weld or perpendicular to the weld, depending on the nature of the examination. These same robots, as I had indicated earlier, were used for steam generator inspection. They have been used for head inspection, and they could probably paint your car, given the right programming. So it's universal. And I have seen the programming language, and the programming that goes into it. They use wire models. And we do sometimes go back and check a few specific points and then verify it in situ by looking at the data to verify that what we think is truth is actually the ground truth. Yes. Another examination that I noted earlier was the other alloy 600 component, and this is very much of interest to the industry. We'll see a slide on this, but where the carbon steel nozzle wells to the main coolant piping. It's carbon steel going to a dissimilar metal, the stainless steel. A small section of that weld is made with alloy 600, the bad actor, the same thing that the reactor head tubes are made out of. So that all eight nozzles were examined. Even though the requirement would have been to examine fewer number of nozzles, we took this opportunity, another industry initiative, to examine all eight nozzles. And we found no indications of structural discontinuities So here's a picture, a photograph of a robot installation. What we're looking down at the reactor vessel. This is actually Wolf Creek, but it would look just like this on ours. The lower robot is already installed down below, and it's happily scanning away down below on its assigned weld, while the upper robot is about to contact the vessel and start its own series of examinations. The transducer sleds are changed out remotely. The robots don't have to come to the surface. They have long poles with manipulators, and they have quick change fixtures on there where they can swap out transducer assemblies depending on the particular assignment of that robot. Next slide, please. The internal inspections, we noted earlier that the internals were left in their stand, and this gives us an opportunity to inspect both the inside and the outside. It was conducted with a thorough visual examination. It was conducted with a remote-controlled submarine, very small submarine, and with a high-acuity cameras. And the examination looked at all areas of the internals looking for signs of structural distress, and none were found. And again, this examination was recorded on digital media for future reference. Next slide, please. So the results of this entire examination, all vessel shell wells were examined for ASME code and procedural requirements, again within the limits imposed by the geometry of the vessel. No indications exceeding code acceptance criteria were detected. All out, the alloy material locations in the nozzle, the pipe wells, and the BMI, the bottom-mounted instrumentation tubes, which are an industry concern, were also inspected. And the supplementary inspection of the nozzle pipe to similar metal wells were conducted in accordance with the latest procedural requirements, and no indications of structural distress were detected. I believe that's the last slide. Are there? That concludes. Are there any questions?
No questions.
No questions. Excellent presentation.
Thank
very,
you.
Very informative and quite a piece of work.
We're very fortunate to have people like Dave and Mike on the team. They're very good.
And we'll do it again in 2R13.
Okay.
So they get it right.
Okay. Under next presenter is under tab 4, Bob Prigmore. Bob is a supervisor of quality assurance, quality verification, and standing in for Dave Taggart, our manager. He's going to talk about the year-end results as determined by quality verification.
Thank you, Dave. Good afternoon. Dave Taggart couldn't be here this afternoon. He's at an industry quality assurance director managers meeting. So I get to stand in for him. This, as Dave mentioned, is an year-end quality verification assessment of plant performance. This first slide indicates what our grading criterion is. Green basically is our top tier, which we are very it's the most difficult grade to get. Basically, major areas of performance in each organization must consistently exceed expectations. So that's going to be very difficult for any organization to achieve. In our view, we're going to grade each organization as strictly as we possibly can. White performance is consistent at meeting expectations regarding implementation of policies and programs, etc. And gaps to top tier are identified and in the corrective action program, and the organization is aggressively pursuing corrective actions. If we have an organization that is in yellow, we believe that the effectiveness of their corrective actions isn't as aggressive as it should be. So we're trying to drive those organizations. Next.
No, great.
Overall?
Yeah.
Is
overall.
It? No.
I do believe it was graded yellow in the couple years ago overall plant performance.
Uh-huh.
The grading scale has shifted over time, too.
Yes.
Which
yes.
is something else to remember. And if the overall performance were to get and you see a lot of green across the departments, and overall performance was, you know, excellent. I'd be asking them to change their standards again.
Right.
Yeah. So the idea is to not to maintain performance, but to continue to improve it. And in my mind, they're the watchdogs to make sure we're doing the right stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, to answer your question, we changed this grading scale about 7 months ago and tried to make it a little more specific so that people could really see how it was clearly defined, to more clearly and specifically define what the colors meant. Mm-hmm. And so it's much easier to make it stand out. I think if we were to really think that an organization was green, that's going to be a big step for us. And we're looking to challenge each organization and look for any areas that we feel they need to improve in.
So, Dave, I guess a continuing improvement organization, with every time it hit green, you'd raise the bar to keep it going, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Bob, you said you're getting more understanding and confidence from the line organizations in the work that you're doing and with the findings you're making. Am I right about that? That there's been a change?
I believe that's true. Yes, that's, if I understand the question correctly.
Well, I think you probably know what I'm getting at, whether I've articulated it properly or not. Does the fact that your organization reports directly to Mr. Oatley have anything to do with the improved confidence? Is there a difference, and could that have something to do with it?
I'm not sure if that has anything to do with how the organization might view us or how we behave towards the rest of the organization or any way like that.
If I could add to what Bob's saying, in that last bullet when it says there's a new sense of staff confidence throughout the organization, Bob's team is referring to the site overall and not in confidence in quality verification, but in confidence that we're continually improving and we're making big strides in that regard. When Dave Taggart discussed this in front of the President's Snoop Advisory Committee, it was you know, Dave and Bob's organization's assessment that the organization a year or so ago, where we were struggling with performance issues, didn't have the same confidence in ourselves. And today there is a stronger confidence, if you will, in the accomplishments we've made and in the next steps we need to take.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does that help answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, next. So some good performance to start off with, some things that were good performance during the past year. Diablo Canyon had the second best generating year in its history, and generated 17,755,000 megawatts, which was good, and had operated with operating without any automatic reactor trips again. No forced outage in 2005. The forced loss rate was among the industry leaders. So performances last year was very good. The last line item there, conservative operational decision-making process and implementation. Our observation of that process has been very, very good. For example, during our periodic high swell events that we get, the plant manager brings the core group of leaders together, and they discuss what's forecast and evaluate the conditions and what the models look like and make a good sound conservative operation decision. And all those operational decision making minutes are well documented to provide good direction to the operating organization. So that's a good improvement addressed and resolved.
Does your organization have an opportunity to observe the workings of this committee?
Yeah, our engineering assessment group that my peer supervises and Dave also occasionally sits in on that and observes the working of that group.
My perspective, what it's done is it's provided order from chaos. In other words, previously any person could propose a modification to the plan and throw it into the system, and there was a prioritization scheme, and then there was a dogfight for money. And what the Plant Health Committee now does is it provides a much more rigorous review of any modifications proposed, a formal grading scale for priority. It takes into account risk, safety, reliability, and how long the issue's been out there that it's trying to resolve. And that provides a much more defensible position when you're going into the budget cycle. So it's a much more stable situation in the context of we know what we need to do, we get the funds, and we then resolve the issue. Where the funds were always available before, it was not as rigorous of a system to prioritize work and spend the money on the more significant issues. So I think it, in my mind, it brought order to chaos.
What would, in your view at least, what would you think the highest order of priority would be for the Plant Health Committee when they're rendering a decision on AMOD?
The highest order, so I would look at that as like what are some of the factors that go into determining the priority?
Well, you may want to do X. And an NRC inspection report, for example, might suggest that something has been hanging out there for a long period of time. When the Plant Health Committee sits down and tries to weigh the value of what they or the plant might want to do versus this long-standing item, what kind of deliberation takes place before somebody automatically says, let's fix this NRC issue?
The process uses three elements to determine priority. One is what's the probability of it affecting, safe, reliable operation. What the second element would be, what's the consequence if the item did fail? What would be the consequence? And then the third one is how long has the item been unresolved? So there's a time issue with weights in it. And those are the three elements that go in. We don't bring into the discussion some agency or some person wants it done, and so there's a large weighting factor that's applied against it. However, in practice, what would happen is if the Nuclear Regulatory Commission found there to be an issue, that is an issue. Right? And just because the NRC found it, we wouldn't want to go fix it necessarily. But the fact the issue is there causes us to want to go fix it. Mm-hmm. And that factors in the priority scheme. So if you were to do a comparative analysis between issues that the NRC has found and their higher priority issues, they tend to overlap pretty nicely. But again, it's not because a third party is forcing us. It's just that's the NRC through their risk-based approach of regulation. They call out the riskier.
I'm sorry. The reason I brought it up was one could be convinced that the formation of a Plant Health Committee, which I support that. I think that's a good idea, and I think it's if it's functioning properly, it's a very constructive way to go. It can also create a situation where Plant Health Committee decisions are made very simple, and the recognition by the regulator that this group exists affords them an opportunity to try to come up with a list of things that they'd like to see you get done. That's why I wondered how this kind of judgment was balanced. How do we sit down between the House of Representatives and the Senate and figure out what the bill is going to look like?
Right. And so the process I described is the process that's used. The other thing the committee does is it determines up front is a modification, which is really what they're approving for all intents and purposes. Mm-hmm. Is a modification really the most effective way and most timely way of resolving the issue, or is there a maintenance aspect or other method that we can employ much sooner to resolve an issue? And So their audit looks at those two things, and there's modifications that are proposed that aren't adopted by the Plan Health Committee. Once the Plan Health Committee proposes a resolution, it goes to a committee I chair, which looks at the timing of when things occur. And we also take a look at various aspects of to determine the timing, social issues as well as safety and reliability.
Just one last follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
Is it a possibility when this Plant Health Committee
looks at various options available to resolve it and recommends to the Project Review Committee the most cost-effective option? So that's how we've lined up the three elements.
That's clear. That's what I'm saying. Thank you.
Yes, in addition, the only thing I would add to what Dave was talking about is to make the other thing the Plant Health Committee is doing is assuring that from what we've seen, is assuring that a corrective action that will resolve the issue is implemented. In other words, we would also look at effectiveness of corrective action, which is one thing we always look for. And what we've seen so far, especially out of 1R13, is that very effective corrective actions have come out from that process. And for example, the ECCS void corrective action for Unit 1 was an excellent effort and seems to have been very effective. So,
you put it number one on your list with respect to improving performance. So I'm making a judgment. You see that as being a home run.
Yeah. So it's also, we'll get to it. It's on another slide also. Management observation program, we're seeing significant improvements in that. During the outage, we saw over 1,300 management observations just during the outage period. Program itself, the database, the newly implemented database just prior to the outage is working out very well. It's very easy to use for the managers, supervisors that perform the observations. It provides good metrics back to the managers right away. So that's something that we're seeing an improvement in. Continuous improvements in that area are ongoing.
I might ask you the same question again, but with respect to outage performance, significantly improved. How do you base that judgment?
Based on the numbers and the quality of the observations that were performed in the past. During the outage, my group and I also went in and looked at the observations that were being documented during the outage, and they were extensive, and there were a lot of issues identified that lessons learned, things identified where coaching had occurred right on the spot, and were carried over to later tailboards, things of that nature.
And you have a means of comparing what occurred in 1R13 with evidence of what occurred or didn't occur in previous outages. Is that how you make this significant improvement?
During the previous outages, you didn't have the capability of taking a card and transposing it that quickly. This particular database was instantaneous. As soon as it was a plant-wide database that belongs to the performance improvement group, managed by the performance improvement group. Excuse me, and it was instantaneous, and all observations went into the same database. It was a very, very good program.
So, thank you.
Another improvement. We had no disabling injuries throughout the year. That was excellent. Our security issues that occurred during the outage were the lowest that we've ever had. We improved performance towards right at the end of the year by getting our drill and exercise performance indicator back to green status, where it had dipped below green to white, which took an extensive amount of effort on the part of the emergency preparedness group. and we did see overall improvement in outage performance.
Before you move forward, did you, and did I miss, did you speak about the implementation of performance improvement governance? Did I miss it?
Who's approving for it, Bob?
I must have missed that. The performance improvement, I must have missed that. I'm sorry, Sheila. Yeah, there has been effective implementation of that performance improvement governance board. It's improving performance. There are a number of things that have been implemented with that. Metrics being reviewed on a very frequent basis. I'd ask Dave to talk about it because he's heavily involved in it too, but there are reviews on a monthly basis with each manager to make sure that they're meeting their goals. We have no over back to green, and that's basically I have to check my notes here.
Yeah, I can help you a little bit. Okay. So on the drill net size performance indicators, NRC performance indicator, measures the accuracy and the timeliness of event classifications and protective action recommendations. And the criteria is to stay 90% accurate and timely, time being within 15 minutes or greater. We dipped below that in the third quarter, and it turned out to be the second quarter of last year slightly. The causes were a lack of knowledge on parts of some regarding when making the classification emergency event, fill out a form, and we weren't very clear that the accuracy of that form, even during drills and simulator exercises, was how we were measuring whether we met the performance indicator value or not. So while the vast majority of the classifications and corrective action recommendations were accurate and timely in the context of making the decision, when they translated that to filling out a fairly detailed form, we found mistakes where wind speed was entered, where wind direction should have been, some boxes not checked, those types of things. And most of those errors were occurring on the simulator because you're asking the shift managers to practice making the calls. The remediation was retraining on not only the initial conditions to classify an event during the various emergency levels, but also when filling out the form, what level of accuracy we're looking for here, which is a fairly high degree of accuracy. We understand the need for that. And then we set out in the month of the fourth quarter, which was primarily November and the first part of December, we had 250 opportunities where 250 emergency classifications or protective action recommendations. Each shift manager, site emergency coordinator, and recovery manager, and I'm a recovery manager, I went through at least half a dozen or so drills with several opportunities to make a mistake or succeed. Out of the 250 opportunities, we made three errors, and so it was a very high accuracy rate. And we're repeating that same number in the first quarter of this year. It's all about getting the performance where we need it. And we recognize that in the end, we would have been able to protect the public health and safety because the right classification was made, and there's a phone call, and that's transmitted. The form and the lack of rigor in completing the form could have resulted in some confusion, and so we're making sure that's solid.
Dave, do you do these in the training building or from your desk?
We do it from the emergency facility. So in my case, I actually go to the emergency operations facility, which gives me an opportunity to stay familiar with that facility, with the phones and the equipment that's out there.
Do others do that too?
Yes. The shift managers do it from the simulator. They go through a simulator exercise and have the indicators show what's going on. They have to diagnose the situation, classify the emergency, and then go fill out the form. They're under probably the tightest time frame because they have to do the actual diagnostics of the boards, figure out what it is, and they got 15 minutes to make that call. And then once they make it, they've got 15 minutes to fill out the paperwork and make the phone calls to the state account. So
when you say paperwork, do you mean paper or on screen?
I mean paper. Take a form out, fill it out, and fax it.
Didn't know they did that anymore.
Most places still do, yes. Because the state and county wants to see, receive a fax version.
And we're still working to get to our station goals. We're still a little bit below our station goals with our performance in this area. But we're above the NRC performance indicator, but we're still striving to get to, and we are still pushing to get to that point. But there was a lot of work done in that area, and a lot of things were improved through that whole process. So, any more, Sheila?
Next.
Okay, these are our key performance issues at this point in time, and they're aligned there with our IMPO performance criteria. Our quality performance issue, our first one is outage preparedness and execution. We still feel that warrants improvement, and there are still such items as scope control that warrants improvement. We're still struggling a little bit with that, although there are initiatives to correct those things. We look for these issues to improve. The longstanding equipment issues are still on this list because we want to see sustainability through to R13. We have seen, as we previously talked about, the improvements through 1R13. We want to see that to continue through 2R13. Improve collective radiation exposure to industry best. We have a good stretch goal for 2R13. However, it's nowhere near industry best. We do have a number of initiatives that are in place after the beginning of this year to improve that. An ALARA manager was recently assigned to help the managers improve and drive dose monitoring in their own areas. And manager dose accounts will allow for better tracking. They're going to have easy to access dose accounts. They're also going to change the login process out at the plant so that they'll be logging in through the work activity, and that will enhance the ability to track by the work. So we're looking at, we will be continuing to monitor that. It's a continued effort to try to observe that the plant is working efficiently and effectively on each job and not using excess dose to perform work.
Bob, we had presentations earlier from Brad Hines and Bob Height, and I think the things you just said are quite right. They're ways to improve, do things more efficiently, and so on. However, the next outage has a very big scope, and some of it's radiation work. And you're not necessarily going to be able to continue the kind of trend that people would like to see, and stretch goals have to be used with great caution because the planners are trying very hard to estimate honestly what they're going to achieve. So the numbers may or may not be the whole story here. So, you know, as long as they do a good job of managing the radiation, I think that's something you're proud of. The numbers are going to depend on what you have to do.
Right, and I think you want your estimate to be as accurate as possible. I think you want to be able to estimate your work as closely as you can to what you believe it's going to be, and estimate efficiently and effectively, and be able to track. You know, these tracking mechanisms that they're going to put in place are going to aid them significantly, not only from now but into the future. So. There's some planning efforts that really need to be improved to be able to accurately forecast what a job activity is going to entail from a dose perspective. And then we need to observe to make sure that everyone is doing their part from time dose shielding or time shielding and
good
perspective. And an improvement in operations mispositioning errors and human performance. We did, QV identified an adverse trend during last outage. Initiatives have been aggressively taken. There have been some human performance issues in operations, and operations again has taken some aggressive action. They've instituted a training program through this first period. We've observed that it seems to be on the right track. They have just implemented a new procedure, the definition and measurement of mispositioned plant components, which includes a metric. And management will now be able to actually, and this is what I was referring to before, with more metrics for performance improvement, that they're going to implement a metric that management will actually be able to look at on a frequent basis that's indicating how well operations is doing in this area. And they'll be able to more rapidly address these items when something's not going quite right in the area of mispositioning. They have to get their arms around this.
This is Bob, just a quickie.
Yes, sir.
Earlier, and a couple of times today, Dave Oatley talked about a concern with respect to mispositioning errors. And I think I heard you say that one of the improvements that operations was undertaking was additional training. Is that...
We don't believe that there's any issues with our operator training program per se. The training, though, that the operations manager is doing himself, which I really have to applaud him for doing, is it's dealing with operator fundamentals. And this isn't the detailed knowledge of, you know, here's where the valve is, this is what the valve does, this is how the system interacts. Not that type of operator fundamentals. But a situational awareness when you are in, you are realigning a system, especially during an outage, you're in off-normal configurations constantly. And you have procedural guidance and you have clearance instructions that you have to follow verbatim. But that may not always be enough. You still need to have a fundamental understanding of what it is you're trying to accomplish as you're realigning the plant. Maybe you're trying to move water from this tank to that tank. And so you ought to be aware of, as you're realigning things, what is the objective of what you're doing as another level of check on the actions you're taking. You don't want operators to blindly follow procedures. You want operators to follow procedures. And so it's what training that Steve David is giving is around that.
I see.
When you're out and you're realigning the plant, you're opening valves, you're closing valves, you're opening breakers, you're closing breakers. You're doing that work by a series of procedures. You actually have to follow the procedure, but always in your mind as an operator, you need to know what it is you're trying to accomplish. And be checking that against what you're doing as a second verification, third verification.
That's also known as having a mental model of what's going on at
yes.
any time.
Yes.
Same type of thing.
Does that help your question?
Yeah, it does. And it'll be interesting to see if that kind of training becomes an asset in terms of addressing this issue.
And I think it's a very good tool and a very good thing to do. I think the program on mispositionings, the metrics and how we count it and look at it, we borrowed that program from Exelon, who's InfoSet has a state-of-the-art program. We brought that in, and the procedure was created and improved just last week, or week before last, and that is another tool we're going to be using. So I look at the two as being having to be used together to affect you.
Thank you.
Does it use case studies? I mean, just stories about
yes.
incidents?
Real life case studies, yeah. Yes. Yeah, Steve, for
Bob, QV identifies these issues, performance issues here, and brings them forward. It's the line organization's responsibility to correct these issues or improve on them.
Yes, sir.
And do it in a timely manner. What's QV's responsibility if they see this line organization not making any progress in improving this? What's y'all's responsibility then?
We will continue to elevate the issue either through our quarterly performance assessment report and through the vice president, station director.
They meet with me monthly, and they let you know for a fact that they tell me when they think progress is slow in a certain area.
Good. Has a good effect. Okay, these are our key issues that we removed during this period. Outage extensions due to equipment failures. That was removed. Now, Dave's words were that because there's a really good program going on now, and we also had no issues with failure of these equipment failures coming out of the last outage. I believe this is due to our ODM and our operational decision making, and in part with the Plant Health Committee. And in talking to the engineering assessment group, they said that yes, the Plant Health Committee is monitoring what's going on during the outage. So before this, we didn't really have a very good process for making sure that we had addressed all potential problems during the outage, coming out of the outage. Management observations on the learning organization side. Again, we have seen significant improvement in that area, which is not to say that it is completely, you know, green or where at the end of where we want it, but it is improving, and we have seen significant improvement. So that has come off our key station issues list. Operating experience, we had a problem with that last year in getting timely evaluations or timely review for applicability. A new program was basically implemented, and metrics were developed to assure that when we get a new operating experience the previous process created problems. Our other quality performance issues that need improvement that we are continuing to follow. Human performance and maintenance engineering and RP. We saw some issues with this at the end of last year, and we are continuing to follow these maintenance issues with human performance during the outage. We had a couple of clock resets. Engineering, we had a couple of clock resets. RP, we had a couple of issues there. So there are human performance areas in human performance that we're continuing to follow. The second bullet is primarily a maintenance area, and that deals with work order documentation of as found conditions. We're looking for improvement in that area. They've already initiated actions for improvements there, and we'll continue to follow that. Preventive maintenance tasks exceeding grades without prior evaluation. The plant manager actually requested a non-conformance report on this, did a cause evaluation. The cause was actually identified, and the actions to address that will be coming forth pretty soon, from what I've been told today. Rework identification. This is not an issue of excessive rework or a problem from that perspective. It's an issue with implementation of the program and identifying the rework items in our trend program and using that trend program as a learning tool to identify the things that should be learned from that process. consistent troubleshooting implementation. We've been following troubleshooting for some time. We have a good procedure in place at this point in time. Maintenance owns this troubleshooting procedure. There's some difficulty in getting into the troubleshooting procedure. Some people like to gather data or investigate rather than troubleshoot. So we're trying to identify get the organizations to come together and basically say they're troubleshooting. So we will continue to follow that issue. And it's not an issue of a problem with the way that people are troubleshooting. We have a good troubleshooting procedure. They've got a good troubleshooting database where they document their formal troubleshooting of systems and components that they have problems with, and it's very extensive when they do get into it. So it's more a procedure of consistency issue. The scope, stability, and the planning metric are work control issues. It's a work control program that we have been implementing for the past few years that needs to be more of corrected. The scope stability factor has been low. The planning metric has been off a little bit and has not been meeting its goals. The work control manager has been on a separate assignment, and that may have had an effect, but he's back now and he's taking initiatives to correct those problems. So these are somewhat small in nature, but we want the work control program to assure that the resources are being effectively utilized out at the plant, and that work is being planned and implemented appropriately. An adverse trend for EP equipment problems was identified by the equipment reliability group, and we are following that. The restoration of the fire protection system to green is not planned until 2011. It's actually 2009.
Adequate water supply through enlarging tank capacity and other tanks, and then getting the license amendment to have the power source tank out of service for a while, replace it, and then bring it back into service.
I was curious when I saw this about how the plant health committee has addressed fire protection. We looked at an audit, I guess, a year or two ago, a couple years ago. And the audit for the fire protection system brought up the fact that there were a lot of things, I just call it being neglected on that system, even though the system engineer seemed to be pushing his cause. And has the Plant Health Committee elevated that to a pretty high position?
Yes, it has. That came before the Plant Health Committee. It was one of the first systems, I believe, that Jim Becker, VP of Operations, he chairs the Plant Health Committee, asked to come forward to the Plant Health Committee. It got a pretty high score, and we're going forward with funding.
Okay, good.
That's a good example of how you can, how the Plant Health Committee is putting the proper prioritization.
Yeah. I would agree. It's good. Good for that system.
Yes, we have recognized that system engineer does advocate very strongly for that system. And finally, on that page, we do need to focus during the next outage. We need to focus on improving the rate of recordable injuries. We did have some recordable injuries during the outage. They were not a large number, but we want to make sure we don't have any injuries during the outage. Next. And this is from the second page. This is the ratings that we currently have. From the fourth period where the organizations are rated. And rather than go through the entire list here, I would just leave it for questions.
That's listed emergency prepared is still in the yellow, did
Sir?
That's listed in emergency preparedness still as a yellow, ready
yes,
to
sir.
Go.
Yes, sir.
Work to do.
Bob, I have a question. You've read the steam generator replacement project, the Nexus project, is green. Is that because of schedule? I mean, these are things that are going to really, they're ongoing, but they're really going to come to fruition sometime in the future. So when you rate them as green, it's because they're proceeding according to schedule?
Yes, we have a project team that's been very effectively managing steam generator project as far as the contractors, as far as all the elements for the steam generator replacement and managing the contractors and staying on top of the contractors and the different elements that go with the steam generator replacement.
So I think it's fair to say it's more than schedule, it's also the quality.
Yeah, okay. Yes. It's the whole thing. If you look at White Used Fuel Storage Project, that's had some issues. So it's not just the far out. The things that haven't come to fruition yet are automatically green. That's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, that wasn't my assumption. I just wanted to know what your evidence-based criteria was for identifying these as green.
Right.
I mean, like the Nexus project, for example. You know, push will come to shove, and you'll find out when it goes live. I mean, so being well managed to this point certainly helps to answer my question. Thank you.
Right. We have quality verification people on the Nexus project. That work for Dave, and of course we have quality verification personnel that are staying on board with the steam generator replacement project and the used fuel storage project. So that's an ongoing thing.
So have you had any organizations that are red lately?
We did. We had emergency preparedness red after the DEP went south. Yes, sir.
Pretty much the only one. They're working their way back up now. It looks like
yeah.
The yellow and then on. Okay. All right, I have one sort of administrative question. The agenda item, we have year-end results for the quality performance assessment report and the quality verification assessment report. I'm trying to determine the difference in the two reports.
So were we, and that's why we gave you the presentation on the quality problem assessment report. Which it really is the same thing as Q quality verification assessment.
So the QPAR is really the report, and there's no such thing as a QVAR.
I haven't seen a QVAR.
No, okay. QVAR.
QPAR, okay. That's what I thought about. All right.
That completes this presentation.
Yeah,
that's true. This brings us to the end of our afternoon session. We're about a few minutes ahead of schedule.